The president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
And we do have secret prisons. That is not what America's all about.
Let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. It's a dangerous world we live in. And of course, that became even more clear last week when two of the old axis of evil, North Korea and Iran, both have, well, events that America has to deal with. You remember the axis of evil. This was George Bush's formulation. He coined the term for the three countries, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. It was always an awkward formulation. After all, unlike the real axis, the axis powers in World War II, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea aren't even allies. Indeed, Iran and Iraq have been formidable enemies for much of their history, as Arab-Sunni Iraq would fight with Persian Muslim Iran, most recently in the 1980s, when more than 1 million people died in those wars. It was also not quite right as a formulation because Iraq never quite fit in to the far more dangerous Iran and North Korea. Today it is clear, indeed it was clear a decade ago, that Iran and North Korea were both aggressive countries built on obtaining nuclear weapons, possibly using them, possibly giving them to terrorists. Iraq, not so much. Ever since the Persian Gulf War, Saddam Hussein's army was much weaker. He wasn't really having aggressive designs on another country, and he certainly wasn't going after nuclear weapons. History, of course, is clear. The United States decided to attack the weakest of the three, Iraq. And now we have North Korea and Iran stronger today than they've ever been before. North Korea developed nuclear weapons under the George Bush Jr. regime, something that Bill Clinton had worked very hard to prevent North Korea from doing. And now, just a week ago, they launched a nuclear test so strong that even Russia and China have joined in condemnation on sanctions. Iran has had elections. Well, elections of a sort. They're not exactly a democracy. Their supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, decides who gets to run for the elections. And even then, the candidates, Ahmadinejad and Mousavi in this case, well, Mousavi doesn't really have much of a chance. Ahmadinejad gets all the press, and those who support Mousavi are not allowed to use the internet. They're not allowed to use their cell phones, which have been jammed. They're not allowed to meet and congregate in large numbers. For example, the Tehran Stadium was torn down. Nevertheless, there was an election. It happened just a few days ago, and no one seems to understand what happened. Was it a free and fair election? Well, put it this way. Ahmadinejad is known to have had a lot of strength in the countryside, and Mousavi had support in the cities. Yet Ahmadinejad claimed 70% victory in the cities. It seems highly unlikely this is a fair election, particularly as Iran refused to allow any kind of international observers over the ballot box. So where do we go from here? What do we do with the two remaining axis of evil, the two who were strong to begin with, far stronger than the one we attacked? In fact, Iran is much stronger today precisely because we attacked Iraq, its traditional counterweight in the region. Iraq is gone, and now we have the Iranian head, Ahmadinejad, talking about Iran having nuclear weapons. Where do we go from here? To answer these questions, I've invited a special guest. Her name is Rachel Kleinfeld. She is the executive director of the Truman National Security Project. This is a project named after Harry Truman. Of course, Harry Truman was a Democrat, but a muscular one, as it were, the author of both the Marshall Plan and the Containment Doctrine. It was Harry Truman who decided in the late 1940s not to allow Greece and Turkey to fall under communist rule and to use containment as a way to prevent the attacks on the Soviet Union. What is the role of a progressive foreign policy? Most progressives, including myself, oppose the war in Iraq, but most of us also supported the war in Afghanistan. After all, Afghanistan, or the Taliban in Afghanistan, harbored Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda killed 3,000 innocent Americans. But But where do we go from here? Do we allow a nuclear arms race among aggressive dictatorships? Do we have reason to fear not just North Korea and Iran, but countries responding to North Korea and Iran, and thus leading to a nuclear arms race? It's not an easy question. And I'd like to take each country one by one, and then I'll invite my guest on and get her views on both countries. Let's start with North Korea. Now, North Korea, as you may recall, has always been an aggressive dictatorship ever since the Korean War back in the 1950s under Harry Truman, interestingly enough, and later on Dwight Eisenhower, when you had North Korea invade the South and try to make it part of its dictatorship. We defended South Korea, indeed the entire world did. It was a United Nations action. Fought back to a line of control, a boundary line based basically on where the forces ended in 1954, that has pretty much been the line of demarcation ever since, with very heavily armed South Korea and North Korean powers looking at each other. We, of course, aided the South Koreans. The North Koreans were aided by either Russia or, more particularly, China. That's how it's lasted for the last 50 years. While things have gone well in South Korea, South Korea has transformed into a fairly vibrant democracy and, frankly, a fairly strong economic power. Their growth has been phenomenal. The South Koreans clearly have done very well with capitalism and so forth. North Korea, well, things are not as good there. North Korea had famines where more than 1 million people died. And as anyone can tell you who studies the food distribution systems in the world, that doesn't happen by accident. It's today there's more than enough food to feed every hungry person in the world. And if large numbers of people die from starvation, well, it's as true with North Korea as it was with the Irish potato famine back in the 1800s. There's a political reason. And the reason is that the dictatorship of Kim Jong-il does what it can to help itself at the expense of its people. Recently, of course, and when I say recently, I mean the last 20 years or so, Kim Jong-il has actively pursued nuclear weapons. It's not clear exactly where the technology and the know-how came from. Perhaps they developed it internally. Perhaps it came from Mr. Khan, A.Q. Khan, a Pakistani, who helped them with their nuclear program. In any case, Kim Jong-il has been actively working on nuclear weapons. And it's about the only thing going for that country. It's a country where people are starving and living under the boot of one of the harshest dictatorships in the world. In any case, in the 1990s, Bill Clinton negotiated with Kim Jong-il and signed a memorandum of understanding, one that, frankly, was a payoff, and one I supported. One that said, we will give North Korea food aid, we will give them free food aid, we'll even give them free civilian nuclear know-how. Well, not so much the know-how, we'll give them the energy. As long as they're being watched very carefully, as long as the United States and the other members of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the nuclear watchdog group for the world, can come in, can watch to make sure that they're not making nuclear weapons out of it. It was a payoff, it was a bribe, and yet sometimes you have to do that. Kind of like paying protection money to the mafia. Sometimes the protection money is cheaper than the damage that you might think they may do. And in Bill Clinton's case, he decided, and was criticized by Republicans for this, that giving them a little bit of food aid was more important to stop them from developing nuclear weapons, and much better than, having a war. So we did that, and that lasted throughout the 90s. Indeed, North Korea did not develop its nuclear weapons any further from 1993 until 2001. Then came the Bush administration. And what happened in 2001? Camera 3? What happened in 2001 was that George Bush was occupied with September 11th. He was occupied with Afghanistan, Pakistan, and later on, the war in Iraq, and he took his eye off North Korea. And what did Kim Jong-il do? He did it very publicly. He shut down the cameras watching the nuclear production. He shut down the cameras. He declared to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that he was withdrawing from his requirements, withdrawing from the deal he signed with Bill Clinton, and he actively stepped up production of nuclear weapons. I remember it very well because I was working in Congress at the time. As an attorney, I was on the Homeland Security Committee and also on the Judiciary Committee, working for progressive Democrats. And we knew, the whole country knew, that North Korea was busy developing a nuclear weapon. But George Bush was bogged down. He wanted to go to war in Iraq. The Republicans focused on that, and they took the eye off the ball. And so a country far more dangerous than Saddam Hussein, Kim Jong-il, a leader far more dangerous than Saddam Hussein, a country far more dangerous than Iraq, was allowed to develop nuclear weapons under George Bush's watch. And now, what's President Obama to do? He inherited a very tough situation. Just last week, North Korea detonated, against international law, a nuclear weapon. So much so that even his supporters in China got nervous. And China and Russia and the entire world has issued sanctions under the United Nations, sanctions that will allow North Korean ships to be boarded so that if they can't provide nuclear weapons to terrorist groups, something they have said they might do. But North Korea has said if that happens, it's a full declaration of war. Pretty scary events, particularly when we've got problems in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and I haven't even talked about Iran yet. What is to be done about North Korea? Hold that thought while I talk about Iran. In Iran, you have an interesting situation. There is, of course, the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. He's the guy in charge. For all the talk about Ahmadinejad, let's be clear who's in charge here. The supreme leader, 70-year-old Ali Khamenei, who's been there for 20 years running the country ever since the death of Ayatollah Khomeini. He's the one who chooses who gets to run for office. And whenever you have an election between two people and both people are chosen by one man, you get an idea of, what kind of election it is. Yet still, the Iranian people have had a chance through this fake election process to let their voices be heard. Despite the fact that the internet is shut down in Iran, you didn't have, for example, the Iranians hearing President Obama's masterful speech in Cairo a few weeks ago. Despite the fact that cell phones have been jammed because the Iranian regime doesn't want Iranians talking to each other. Despite the fact that it's been outlawed for Iranians to use things like Facebook and MySpace to congregate, and they've, of course, been refused permits to meet in Tehran's sports stadium, which is what the alternative candidate, Mousavi, wanted to do, still, people are out in the streets. I don't know how they get the word around, but it's grassroots. It's spontaneous, and they wear the color green. And even today, after Ahmadinejad declared victory, a large number of people are not accepting it, and they are massing in the streets. Is this Iran's Tiananmen Square? Is this a case where we're going to see a brutal crackdown by the regime against its own people? And where should the United States be? Specifically, where should progressive Democrats be on this? Progressives understood, I think, in a way that, say, the neoconservatives didn't understand, that there are all kinds of ways to throw American power around. You don't always have to go to war. There is soft power. President Obama understands that sometimes negotiations can achieve, or even sanctions can achieve, far more at far less cost than even a war. So where do we go from here? Iran looks likely to develop nuclear weapons very soon. By the end of this year, maybe by the end of next year, maybe by the year after that. They've already demonstrated missile technology, not the liquid fuel, but the solid fuel technology that would allow it to attack Israel, to attack much of Europe. It's a very dangerous state. How do we deal while at the same time dealing with controversies that continue, war that continues in Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan? Lebanon had a free election. I want to talk about that too. An election where the people voted out the radical Muslim clerics. Where do we go from here? How do we address these very difficult problems at a time when America is suffering a depression of its own? It's not an easy question for the Obama administration. It's not an easy question for my guest either, Rachel Kleinfeld. I'll be asking her them after the break. If you want to call in, toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
She's had more than a dozen fractures. And in the next few years, she faces two major surgeries to strengthen her fragile bones. She's only 10 years old. Most people don't worry about fragile bones until late in life. For those with osteogenesis imperfecta, brittle bones are a concern throughout their lifetime. Find out how you can strengthen this child's future.
Diabetes is a killer. After I was diagnosed, I didn't feel sick, so I didn't listen to my doctor. Then it struck. I had a heart attack, then a stroke, and I was only 49.
Most people with diabetes also have high blood pressure and cholesterol, which can cause severe heart damage. In fact, 2 out of 3 people with diabetes die from heart disease or stroke.
Don't let diabetes destroy your life.
Call for your free diabetes survival guide. Choose to live.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. We are talking about the national security crises that we are facing in the United States and around the world, specifically North Korea and Iran. But it's important to note that these crises have reverberations in other countries. In Iraq and Afghanistan, what's going on in Iran affects those countries. Iraq, of course, is a majority Shia nation. They're Shia Arabs versus the Shia Persians of Iran. And, well, they might be sympathetic in many ways to Iran, but how much Iranian influence is in Iraq to begin with? There's a lot of questions here. For example, we had people that were helping the United States that turned out to be Iranian agents. And then you have Lebanon. In Lebanon, you have an armed insurgency, Hezbollah, one that we know for a fact does not have majority support. Lebanon just had an election on Thursday where the people voted more than 60%, really an amazing election, against Hezbollah. Because the majority of Lebanon still wants a country, a Western-leaning country, where you don't have an armed insurgency like Hezbollah attacking Israel, getting response in return, and basically having an army separate from the Lebanese army. But the Lebanese army is weak, and the international community isn't helping any. The United Nations passed a resolution promising that they would disarm Hezbollah. This was a promise made to Israel. It was a promise made to the people of Lebanon. And the international community hasn't fallen through on its promises. They are not disarming Hezbollah, even though there's a United Nations resolution requiring them to do so. You have tens of thousands of French and Italian troops. I guess they're sitting around drinking espresso. They're certainly not helping to defuse a potentially tense situation. So where is Barack Obama in all of this? What should our president do? He has said in the campaign that he would talk with anyone, including our enemies. And that's understandable. It's the right way to start. But what do you do when our enemies won't talk to us? What do you do when they are determined to develop nuclear weapons, notwithstanding anything else? Their argument, Iran's argument, North Korea's argument is, yeah, well, they won't admit they're dictatorships. But yeah, we're dictatorships. Yeah, we don't have freedoms. But hey, why shouldn't we have nuclear weapons? You have nuclear weapons. The United States has nuclear weapons. Indeed, the only country that has used nuclear weapons is us, the US of A. And of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They say, we're a sovereign nation. You get them, England gets them, France gets them, we get them too. I see a distinction here. I see a distinction between a democracy and a dictatorship with nuclear weapons. I'd rather see no country have nuclear weapons, and our president has said that that's a goal that he has as well. But given that there are regimes today that are dangerous, that have nuclear weapons, I think we're required to have them. But the thing is that the old systems may not work anymore. The way we protected ourselves, so to speak, against the Soviet Union was something called mutually assured destruction. The idea was we had enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world, and the Soviet Union had enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world, and they wouldn't launch against us because we would launch against them. Mutually assured destruction. And that works with a state actor when you have nuclear weapons under the control of a state, such as, the many other states that have nuclear weapons, France, England, Pakistan, India, China, and the undeclared nations of South Africa and Israel. All of them are democracies except Russia and China. That includes, by the way, Pakistan, which although it's was recently a dictatorship, today it is a democracy, even though it's a precarious one. And Russia and China are established dictatorships. I think it's fair to say that they're not going to use their nuclear weapons in a renegade act or in a terrorist act. They will only do so if they're attacked. But what if an unestablished dictatorship gets it? What if someone like Kim Jong-il gets it? Kim Jong-il is getting up in age. He's getting sick. He has already announced that he's going to give the head of North Korea, going to give the whole country to his son, a 26-year-old young man, going over his elder sons. What if there's a family fight? You know, it's amazing for all the talk about a communist dictatorship. Really, it's a kingdom. Really, Kim Jong-il is running his country very much like the old kings, of age, and trying to decide who will run the country. So what if there is a fight? Maybe all of this is all just smoke and mirrors. It's all just a way for North Korea to protect itself in the event that there's a battle of succession after Kim Jong-il. But what are we to do? What is South Korea to do? South Korea has said that it will board the ships. North Korea has ships and they're putting weapons out there, South Korea will board. North Korea says that's an act of war. Will North Korea send hundreds of thousands of troops across the old line, across the parallel, actually invade South Korea, re-begin the Korean War that ended 55 years ago? Or is it all an empty threat? And to what extent should we play brinksmanship? To what extent should we be willing to go to the mat? In Iran, you had, of course, President Obama promise that if Iran does not negotiate in good faith by September or October of this year, we're going to take very strong steps to get rid of the Iranian nuclear threat. What does that mean? Does that mean more than sanctions? Does that mean that President Obama will give Israel permission to take out the Iranian nuclear reactor? I mean, Israel's done it in the past. They did it with both the Iraqi nuclear reactor, the Osirik nuclear plant in 1982. They did it recently with the Syrian nuclear reactor just a couple years ago. But could Israel take out Iran's nuclear weapons? What if they can't? What if they attack one plant, but there are other plants that are producing nuclear materials underground? Some experts say that at this point, Iran has enough plutonium and enough of the know-how to create through centrifuges enough uranium that they can't be stopped. I want to get you in on the question, by the way. My guest is a little late in arriving. She'll be here in just a minute. But if you want to call in, I want to encourage you to do so, and we can discuss until she arrives. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. The local number is 571-749-1166. What do you think we should do? The trouble with being, I guess, a progressive Democrat is that we're realists. We're not going to accept that America's always right and always doing the right thing, no matter what we do, much as the neoconservatives did. And yet at the same time, we recognize that these are severe risks to America. That's, I guess, how I define myself as a liberal. I would define those on the left as those that think that our enemies are not dangerous, that North Korea or Iran or Venezuela, that really it's America's always at fault. And I would define those on the right, to the right of me, the neoconservatives, as those that think that America's never wrong. Those that supported, for example, the coups that we did in Iran back in the 1950s and in Central America ever since then. I try to take a middle, practical position, one that I think that Harry Truman might have taken were he alive today, which is why I've invited a guest from the Truman National Security Project. A realistic idea that America has to stand for its values and at the same time has to protect itself from foreign threats. Now, it's very easy to take an extremist position. On either side, it's very easy to say that American values always trump, that we are pacifist, that we should never have any war, that we shouldn't have a military, that in fact we shouldn't be concerned. If Iran and North Korea want nuclear weapons, let them have it. If they invade and kill millions of people, let them do it. That's not our problem. That's never been my view. I don't think it was Harry Truman's view. That's what I would consider a leftist or pacifist view. I firmly believe that whether in self-defense or to prevent genocide, the United States has to be strong in the world. But then you have the view on the far right, the Dick Cheney view, right? The idea that anything is justifiable, whether it be torture or secret prisons or warrantless wiretapping, that the Constitution of the United States is really, they would say, it's not a death pact. This Constitution is just some words on a page. It really has no meaning. The oath doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter what the United States tortures. They do it too. You can hear Dick Cheney make this kind of defense. Well, Al-Qaeda tortures. Why shouldn't we? Iran tortures. Why shouldn't we? Hey, they fixed their elections. Why shouldn't we? Right? It's a slippery slope. And it's one that I don't want to go down. One of the things that President Obama did in Cairo just a couple weeks ago was he was very clear to say what American values were, that while we would be strong and we would stand up for anything that protects America's national security, at the same time, we would recognize progressive values of democracy and human rights. He mentioned women's rights in the Arab world, something that's rarely talked about. He mentioned free speech. He mentioned freedom of the press. Yet we still live in a dangerous world, right? So to what extent can we have this free press and support democracies and at the same time deal with these dangerous threats? Iran is the classic example, right? We don't want to recognize Ahmadinejad's government because he almost certainly was not fairly elected. And yet we have to deal with him, or specifically with the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, if we want to diminish the Iranian nuclear threat. It's a tough thing to do. Sometimes we've made ourselves friends with countries whose governments are horrific to their own people. Clearly, Egypt is an example of that. We've given Hosni Mubarak billions of dollars in aid, and he is an aggressive, authoritarian dictator. But as Franklin Roosevelt once said, he may be a bastard, but he's our bastard. He said this of, I believe, the Nicaraguan leader at the time. To what extent should we give up on democratic principles because we have to play realpolitik? To what extent should we support dictators because they support American interests? And when do we have to fear blowback? When do we have to fear that doing so will come back to bite us? It happened with Marcos in the Philippines. It happened with Noriega in Panama. It happened with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. While I fully supported helping the Afghanis throw off the Soviet Union at that time, it invaded, we ended up helping the same people that ended up coming to attack us. Yes, we even helped Saddam Hussein. Let's never forget that Dick Cheney was one of the big supporters, and Donald Rumsfeld as well, of Saddam Hussein, shaking his hand and helping give him the chemical weapons he needed to use to kill some of his own people, the Kurdish people. Tough world out there. How do you protect progressive values at the same time as you protect American national security? How do you promote democracy and at the same time don't have these kind of democratic uprisings where people support radical Islamic governments? It's a tough question. I'm going to ask it of my guest. She'll be here right after the break. 888-48-MARK, back after this.
This is firstgov.gov, where we're obsessed with getting you government information.
Brand new student loan applications on the site, baby.
This calls for a celebration.
Here's your uncle.
So in the end, it was either take the astronaut gig or come work here. What can I say? Duty called.
Dude, that's my cop.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that's Sam's cop.
Oh, sorry? Yeah.
No. Sam's. No.
Just log on or email us and get what you need.
C, change of address form. That's how it's done.
D, driver's license renewal.
Mm-hmm. E, emailing social security information.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Nice. Well, all right, then.
What are those?
Government surplus cars for auction.
You posted those online last time.
No, you did.
I'm posting them online this time!
For all your government information, firstgov.gov.
Stop! Oh, what have we got here? Sometimes you feel tired. You can't seem to lose those extra pounds off your midsection. And your joints hurt when you take the stairs. Well, you're getting older. But I'm happy to say that there's some simple things we can do to keep you happy and healthy for years to come. We can also lower your risk for some serious diseases the older population is often subject to. Proper nutrition is more important than ever. Your body has changed, you know. Not as many treats. A basic exercise plan. Lots of walks and fresh air. And most importantly, come and see me for twice yearly checkups to help ensure the best possible quality of life. Now, how does that sound? Good boy.
Improve the quality of life for your elderly pet.
Schedule twice yearly checkups that include preventive care and regular lab work. A message from the veterinary members of the American Animal Hospital Association.
Well,
here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I now have my guest. Her name is Rachel Kleinfeld. She's the executive director of the Truman National Security Project. Rachel, I was talking before you came on the air about Harry Truman's, if you will, liberal ideology on foreign policy as in between a leftist idea and a neoconservative idea. The idea that we need to maintain American values, we need to promote democracy, but we're not pacifists. We need to have sort of a muscular democracy. How do you do it all? I mean, how do you promote democracy when we fear radical Islam and at the same time, you know, not support dictators like those in Egypt that are our allies? How do you find the line between promoting democracy and promoting American interests?
Sure. Well, I think first you start with American interest. You start with what are our goals in the world, and those frankly don't change that much over time. If they're goals, they should last over the long haul. And then you look at what are our values and how do you build our values into those goals so that America stands for what America should stand for, because it's part of what makes us strong.
Let's be specific. What are some of those goals?
Okay, one of our goals is no nuclear Iran, stopping Korea from being such a threat to its region, and building a stable Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asian region so that we're no longer worried about a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, and we're no longer worried about terrorism from Afghanistan.
Now help me out here. Why does this affect the United States of America? I mean, Ahmadinejad, Iran, North Korea argue, hey, we're sovereign nations. You do have nuclear weapons, America. Why can't we have nuclear weapons too?
Sure. Well, it's an interesting point. It's a point a lot of people make, that let every thousand flowers bloom, let everyone have their nuclear weapons. The problems are a couple-fold. One, if a lot of countries have nuclear weapons, there's much more of a chance that terrorists can get their hands on nuclear material. That's the biggest threat right now. That's the threat that Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense, and Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn, a lot of our defense leaders have cited as the number one problem facing America.
The so-called dirty bomb.
Dirty bomb, fissile material, exactly.
Now you can carry nuclear weapons in a suitcase, is that right?
Not exactly a suitcase, but you can carry fissile material, and that's, you know, the mercury from a thermometer is a dirty bomb material. The leftover materials from nuclear waste, bomb material. So you can stick that in anything,
well,
size.
Well, if mercury is a dirty material, mercury is everywhere. Everyone has a thermometer. So, I mean, that sounds like it's very easy to do these terrors.
Well, dirty bombs are pretty easy. What you're talking about with a dirty bomb is similar to what you talk about with an explosive that's packed with nails around it. The nails cause a lot of problem. The explosive sends them out. A dirty bomb does the same thing. It's explosive material surrounded by nuclear waste material of different sorts, and the bomb sends it out, and the waste spreads. But the reality is, scary as the word dirty bomb sounds, it causes problems in its immediate area like a regular bomb.
It might kill dozens of people.
It's not a nuclear
bomb.
Hundreds.
It's not going to kill hundreds of
thousands
of people. Exactly,
exactly.
So the real danger would be a nuclear warhead on top of a missile into some city somewhere.
Exactly, and we still only see that from nuclear states. That's Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, so on.
Now, is there a legitimate fear that North Korea would sell this right to a terrorist group? I mean, one could say they wouldn't do that because if they did that, they would threaten their own regime.
Sadly, there is something of a real fear here. It's not a super likely fear, but it's not a super unlikely fear. It's a fear because North Korea has no economy. Nuclear weapons are their cash crop, and they're basically their only source of economic growth other than counterfeiting American money and the trade that they do with China, which is very minimal.
Well, let's talk about specifically North Korea. Apparently there is a succession crisis or problem, or I don't know. Kim Jong-il, I don't know how his health is, but he's talked about the fact that he's going to give to his youngest son, not his elder sons, mm-hmm. he's going to turn over North Korea. It's interesting. They talk about them being a communist dictatorship. Really, it's more like a kingdom, I think, than the Soviet Union.
Absolutely.
How's his health, and is this succession crisis part of the reason why North Korea is testing nuclear weapons?
Absolutely. You don't need me here. You've already got this figured out. North Korea has a real problem with succession. It's basically a monarchy. that is wrapped in the robes of an autocracy. And so the king, as it were, is trying to pass things on to his youngest son.
How old is Kim Jong-il, by the way?
Kim Jong-il is in his 80s. And Kim Jong-un, the son, the third son, is in his 20s. No one knows anything about this third son. He's very much an unknown factor.
Even in North Korea, they don't know much.
Even in North Korea, they don't know much about
him. So he could turn around, who knows, after his father's death and open up his country to the West. Unlikely?
I suppose it's possible. It's pretty unlikely. It's pretty unlikely. They've been raised in incredible seclusion and with incredible propaganda their entire lives.
So how does Kim Jong-il detonating a nuclear test, causing the entire United Nations, including Russia and China, to support sanctions, causing South Korea, which traditionally has been very scared and very much deferring to North Korea, saying they're even going to board North Korean ships. How is this in Kim Jong-il's interest because of succession? Explain this to me.
It's a very complicated world that they live in North Korea. Basically, power is held in different spheres in North Korea. The military holds some power. There's different generals jockeying for power. And what the father's trying to do is say, hey, I still hold the power here. I've got the ball. I can do a lot of things that will cause trouble, and you'd better back off and let me pass this ball to my son.
Why not do what Stalin did, just have a nice internal purge and kill off 1,000 of your closest people and say, hey, I'm a really scary fella, you don't want to mess with me, rather than threaten the entire world with nuclear weapons?
Fascinating question. Exactly why Kim Jong-il decides to do what he decides to do is pretty unknown to us. We haven't had a consulate there or an embassy there. We have very little insight into the inner workings of that regime.
And it's probably hard to have a spy or good intelligence there either.
We have very little insight into that regime. And what we have comes from dissidents. It comes from people who get out. And there's varying levels of trust in the information we get. All we know is what they do externally, what our satellite photos can pick up, and right now what Google Earth can pick up.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this. I want to know what a progressive response is to North Korea. Bill Clinton famously signed an agreement whereby we gave North Korea aid, but hey, they didn't develop nuclear weapons for 8 years. They were under the aegis of the IAEA. There were extra cameras in the nuclear facility. Mm-hmm. And then under George Bush, he took a more muscular stance, as it were, and they turned off the cameras, they developed nuclear weapons, they became even stronger. Are we going to have to go to war here? How do we stop North Korea?
War with North Korea would be extremely bad, and we want to do everything we can to avoid it. They can be in Seoul, in South Korea, our ally, in 30 minutes. So if we launch war with North Korea, or if North Korea launches war with us, they would destroy an ally, which is extremely problematic for our standing in the world. How to deal with North Korea? You're exactly right. Bill Clinton tried the carrot.
Paid them off, basically.
Paid them off. We bribed them. It worked for 8 years. George Bush tried harshness and tried to threaten them, and they developed multiple nuclear missiles. So really, you're between a rock and a hard place with North Korea. The key to North Korea is China. China holds all the trade relationships, and it holds the key to that regime. And so our best bet is to get China to see things from our perspective.
And they're starting to, aren't they? I mean, supporting us in the sanctions last week, that was unheard of.
Absolutely. It's the first crack in the system. It's the first time China's let anything happen to its ally in that region, North Korea. But
China doesn't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons, do they?
China doesn't want North Korea to fail. What China's very worried about is that if North Korea, if the regime collapses,
then South Korea, it all becomes one United Korea.
It all becomes a United Korea that's a pro-American power in that region, and they have a gigantic refugee crisis on their hands.
Which does China fear most, a American United Korea or a nuclear-armed North Korea?
Clearly, they fear the American North Korea and South Korea more because they've allowed North Korea to get nuclear weapons. That's already happened. They've already gotten the nukes, so they've shown where they have put their cards. How far they're going to allow North Korea to go, that remains up in the air. And with this son taking over, how far they'll allow the son to go also remains up in the air.
And maybe I'm just too much of an optimist, but I have a part of a hope that when you have a regime change and you have an unsteady young man take over, maybe there could be some kind of internal crisis that would cause North Korea to moderate itself. But maybe, is that too optimistic on my part?
Sadly, you might be a little bit optimistic. The chances of some sort of internal coup, of some sort of military coup, are there, certainly. That's what Kim Jong-il is trying to hold off with all of this nuclear brinksmanship. But it could still happen. However, if the military takes over, there's no assurance that the military will be more pro-American than the Sun.
Well, Rachel, I'm going to give you the Mark Levine plan. I was asked the question on what I would do about North Korea 5 years ago, before things were as serious as they were now. And I've put forward this proposal. As far as I know, no serious policymaker has ever taken me up on it. But I'm going to give it out to you. I want to know what you think about it. You're a think tank. You support the
I'd love to know.
Here's the Mark Levine plan. First, what I would do is I would secretly give South Korea nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, under our control, under American control. I would install them, do it as quietly as we possibly can until they're operational. Once they're operational, I would announce them to the world, say, South Korea has nuclear weapons under American control, but we want a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula. And if North Korea will give up their nuclear weapons in a verified way, South Korea will give up theirs in a verified way. China won't want South Korea to have nuclear weapons, or North Korea. They might support such a deal, and if there were an attack, my understanding is that it's not quite as easy as North Korea thinks it is to have a conventional attack on South Korea. You're right, Seoul's 3 minutes away. It's a horrific prospect, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions could die in such a war, but that South Korea's conventional weapons are frankly more modern than North Korea's, and North Korea may just not want to fight a war it may not win. That's the Mark Levine plan. I don't know if anyone else has proposed it. It may be a high-risk maneuver, but in the spirit of Harry Truman, John Kennedy did something similar in the Cuban Missile Crisis. What do you think?
Well, actually, what John Kennedy did in the Cuban Missile Crisis is a good counter to the Mark Levine plan.
Okay,
I find it very interesting.
All right. Feel free to criticize it.
You play high-stakes poker.
I admit it.
So, John F. Kennedy looked as if he was acting very tough with Cuba and Russia. He looked as if he was facing down Cuba and Russia. In fact, he pulled back missiles from Europe, which was one of the requests that the Soviet Union was making at the time. And actually gave the Soviet Union something that it wanted to get the Soviet Union to back down. So in many ways, the opposite of
the Mark
Levine plan.
Well, can we offer a carrot and a stick? I mean, we could, in addition to offering a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula, we could certainly offer aid in helping North Korea's economy, go back to the Clinton idea of giving them food aid and so forth. Nobody wants to see people starve. So carrot and stick. Famously, under Jack Kennedy, of course, Khrushchev sent a carrot and stick message of himself. One promising sort of good aid and withdrawal of the missiles, one promising war, and John Kennedy very famously ignored the stick and only focused on the carrot.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any carrot that will work with North Korea at this point?
You know, there might be some interesting options with the Sun taking power if and when that happens. One is something that was proposed today in the Washington Post, to let the Sun come to America and see America. He's a 20-something-year-old guy. He's never been out of North Korea. He's never seen another country.
Particularly a free country.
What would he make of America? No one knows, but there's little chance that that would cause us more harm than it might cause us good.
Well, I see no problem with that, except that I think it's highly unlikely his father would allow it, maybe once he takes power. And once he takes power, I think that people tend to be surrounded by all kinds of advisors and so forth. He'd be very unlikely to, I don't know, walk into a Starbucks and talk with people there.
Absolutely. He's not going to be given free rein. You know, Khrushchev famously wanted
right.
to go to Disneyland.
Exactly.
He's not going to get to go to Disneyland. But he might have some impression of the United States that causes some dissension in his mind, that causes some dissonance with what he's been told all of his life.
But
that would be an interesting crack in that system.
It's still scary to rely on personality because, you know, he may also understand that, as most dictators do, that you have to crack down hard. If you don't crack down hard, you're not going to be in power for very long. And so I don't know that, Gorbachev famously recognized that his society was falling apart and he wanted to do something to save it. But most dictators simply want to stay in power.
Absolutely. And this is the leverage that we need to work with North Korea. It has very little to do with the population of North Korea.
It's nothing to do with the population of
the government has already shown that they're willing to kill hundreds of thousands of their people for nothing at all, no positive effect. So all of the carrots and sticks need to be focused on the leadership. And that means the smart sanctions that the UN has just allowed us to impose, the sanctions that target those leaders, And I mean, smart carrots. That's why I'm thinking of things like.
I think it's a great idea.
Things that get those.
It's a great idea.
People.
It's certainly painless and costless and could do no harm. But what I mean, you're the executive director of a think tank. It's your job to come up with creative solutions. You've heard my high risk poker solution.
Uh-huh.
What have you proposed as a Truman S. Curry project proposed? Maybe not an answer, but at least a way of dealing with the North Korean problem.
We have not lately proposed any way of dealing with this particular North Korean problem. However, when we talk about it and think about it, the way we think about it is that the route goes through China, that really all of America's focus needs to be helping China understand that it is in their long-term interest to slowly let the air out of the North Korean bubble. They don't want it to burst precipitously. We understand that. We can slowly let the air out, and only China holds that key.
Well, when you talk about slowly let the air out, doesn't that still leave a aggressive North Korean dictatorship with nuclear weapons?
Not necessarily. So
can China stop that now? Hasn't it been done? I mean, they have the know-how. How do you put the genie back in the bottle, as it were?
Well, ultimately, changing North Korea requires regime change. And so ultimately, what you're talking about is the levers that China can use to force that regime to change its activities and to change the way it considers the world. And China has a lot of power over that.
I assume we would prefer a stable Chinese-backed dictatorship over this unstable North Korean homegrown dictator. I mean, China, while certainly not a democracy and brutally mistreat its people in Tiananmen Square, at least we can deal with them, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
We can deal with Russia. These are dictatorships that we have a handle on and are unlikely to give nuclear weapons to terrorists and things like that. Is there a way to help China overthrow Kim Jong-il?
You said it, not me, but yes, those are the kinds of solutions that we should be looking for, are ways that China can see a win-win solution for itself, we can see a win-win solution for ourselves, and slowly we can lead the North Korean Peninsula to a more stable place. Not necessarily the place we would like, not the best place.
Not a democracy.
But not the worst place.
Does China have designs on North Korea to annex it as a province?
Not as far as I know. It's not out there in the public debate, and it's not within the Chinese military debate. But they certainly are, and they've shown with their actions in the UN that they're starting to worry about North Korea.
Let me move on to Iran. Of course, Iran famously had elections just a few days ago. Ahmadinejad declared victory. Did he win the elections?
He might have. I wish that was not the case. But there was a poll by Terror Free Tomorrow, which is an American polling firm that polls in these difficult countries. And they had Ahmadinejad leading by quite a bit in mid-May.
Right, though what I've seen is that there were polls taken in the last month as people focused on the election, and they showed a much greater support from Mousavi and the cities and so forth. I guess the answer is we don't know who won the
election. We have no idea. And in some ways, it doesn't matter at this point because events have outstripped the election itself.
What is going on the ground in Iran today? Are there still protests on the ground?
There are silent protests going on the ground in the hopes that they'll evade the actual police and the sort of mobilized police, the young men that form militant units that go around with chains and so on. There are silent protests. There's angry protests.
But there's
in some
a
of the
huge
hinterlands.
Number of Iranians that are not accepting this election.
Absolutely.
I mean, when I say huge, I'm not talking about a few thousand, hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands of Iranians are in the streets feeling like the election has been stolen.
And they're in the streets right now?
Yes.
And what is the government doing about it?
The government is cracking down on these protests.
What are they doing? Are they violently?
There's violent crackdowns, there's arrests, there's jailing, and there's using various militant arms and youth movements that are not exactly governmental to crack down.
And there are also, technology seems to be the thing the Iranian government fears most. Stopping the internet, stopping cell phones, Facebook, apparently, is a very great danger to the Iranian regime.
Well, the Mousavi forces organized quite frequently through text messages, through Facebook, through these other methods. They weren't allowed by the government to organize in more traditional means before the election, and so they perfected a lot of these other technologies.
Can the government block a text message?
The government can block cell phone communication in different ways.
So they're basically shutting off cell phones so that people can organize.
I don't know what's happened in the last few hours, but they're causing a lot of glitches in the electronic communication system in order to keep people from organizing in the opposition.
What is the danger of Iran? Okay, they're a dictatorship, but after all, in the Middle East, there are dozens of dictatorships, including some that are our allies. Egypt, Saudi Arabia come to mind. What is the danger of Iran?
Iran's government is a big danger, to our allies in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia considers it a huge danger, and Israel clearly considers it a huge danger. The danger is not to America itself, it's to our allies.
And is this a realistic threat? I mean, Iran certainly arms Hezbollah and Hamas. They attack Israel. Israel responds not by attacking Iran, but by attacking Hamas and Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. Is there a real danger? Ahmadinejad famously once said he would wipe Israel off the map. Is there any danger of them pursuing this, or is this all a lot of talk in a way to get the Iranian people not to focus on the economic problems in Iran?
You know, you just can't tell. The Iranian people are extremely pro-American. They're not pro-Israel. There are streets in Iran that are named after suicide bombers who killed Israelis. There are certainly a large number of Iranians who back Ahmadinejad, a lot of young men who back Ahmadinejad. You just can't tell, and that's the problem with Iran. We have to be very careful in acting toward Iran that we don't alienate that younger generation, which is very pro-American, the most pro-American people in the entire Middle East, outside of Israel, frankly. And it's a big youth population there. We want them to be on our side. At the same time, we can't allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon that it can use to threaten its neighbors, and not just Israel, other neighbors as well.
What is the threat to Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia is an Arab kingdom. It's Sunni. Iran is a Persian kingdom. It's Shia. And for hundreds and hundreds of years, they've been antagonistic toward each other. Saudi Arabia right now does not have nuclear arms, and they expect the American umbrella to cover them.
So basically, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, then Saudi Arabia will feel the need to get nuclear weapons, and Egypt will feel the need to get
Precisely.
Nuclear weapons. Perhaps Syria, and then Jordan. I mean, Syria's already tried, apparently. So you'd set off a nuclear arms race, I guess.
Precisely. A nuclear arms race in a region in which we know there are many terrorist groups, and some of those terrorist groups certainly would have an interest in getting nuclear warheads.
In looking for a progressive response to Iran, President Obama's election, and particularly his victory in the primaries, was based largely on opposition to the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, and particularly those that opposed, as I did, the Iraq War, supported President Obama as someone who would take a muscular stance in saying that war was a mistake, bring the American troops home. To some extent, despite the fact that President Obama has said he doesn't want a nuclear-armed Iran, a lot of his supporters say, and I've heard them and they call in on my show, mm-hmm. we don't need another war. Iraq was a big failure. You know, they cried wolf, as it were, about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They lied to us. Mm-hmm. They're lying to us about Iran. Iran isn't really a threat. What would you say to those people?
I would say Iran really is a threat. However,
but why should they believe you when Bush was lying to us 8 years ago? I mean, you're a nice person, but
however, we might need to live with a nuclear Iran. It is not worth going to war over, and a war will not solve the problem of a nuclear Iran. They've built their nuclear weapons program underground. We do not have weapons that can get them underground. We also don't know where their entire program is.
So we're stuck. We're going to have a nuclear arms race now.
Well, not necessarily. There are still many steps that can be taken between this moment and Iran getting a nuclear
bomb. What can be done?
Well, first of all, the vast majority of the population, over 70%, think that Iran should allow in the inspectors, should allow in the international inspectors to inspect their sites.
The vast majority of the Iranian population?
The Iranian population.
Thinks that we should have nuclear inspectors from
thinks that Iran should
Iran
allow nuclear inspectors.
That's very interesting.
Very
that,
interesting.
That 70% of Iran does not want to use nuclear weapons for anything but peaceful purposes.
Exactly. They believe, they're being told, that their government is developing nuclear material for an energy program. Iran is desperately in need of greater energy.
Why? Iran has the third largest oil reserves in the world.
They don't have refining capacity within Iran, and they don't have the money to buy all of the oil that they need
so
from abroad.
So here's my deal, Ahmadinejad, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. You give up your peaceful, you give up your nuclear weapons program, and we'll build you some refineries. How's that?
So there's been talk of this. There's been talk of Russia providing them with fuel for their energy program, for a nuclear energy program, and the fuel going back. And here is where you get the dissension between the leadership and the people, because when the people hear about these kinds of ideas, they're actually very pro those kinds of ideas. There's also some desire for a nuclear weapon purely as a vanity project, purely to say...
True for North Korea as well.
Exactly. Purely to, they want to be a nuclear power. They want to be a big country that's important in the region. If there are ways we can give them some of that respect and give them another way to get the fuel so they don't have that excuse, we might still be able to hold off their nuclear weaponizing.
In terms of giving respect, it seemed that President Obama's speech in Cairo was all about respect.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think you could define that whole 1 hour speech as one word, respect.
Yeah.
to the Muslim world, to Iranians. Now, the Iranian government did not allow their people to hear that speech. All the other countries of the region did. Iran blocked the speech. Do they fear our president's goodwill?
Absolutely. Nobody did more for the Iranian regime than George Bush. George Bush's belligerence and his activity and his axis of evil sort of speech, that helped fuse the government and the people in Iran in a way that really was unnatural.
And it took out the counterweight of Iraq, too.
And it took out the counterweight of Iraq. So nobody was better for Ahmadinejad than George Bush. What we have now is a president who's reaching out, and now the Iranian people can see because they have internet access, they have satellite access.
They do. So Iran can't block it all.
And they can't block it all.
They try. But I assume you have the situation much like you had in China back in the 1980s. You have the people in the cities, university students, people in Tehran, they know what President Obama's up to, but out in the countryside, they certainly don't.
Of course. And you get differential understanding, and you get the government trying to block a site, and the people getting around it, and the government blocking it again.
Who's going to win?
So the youth are a huge portion of the population in Iran. The youth have a very different idea of what they want their country to be. They
Most of the old generation, I guess, was wiped out in the 1980s in the war with Iraq. I mean, it's a heavily young population.
It's a heavily, heavily young population, and they're westernized, they're pro-American.
And they don't hate America because the events of 1979 and before are old news for these people.
Well, and also, unlike Iraq, and much more like Eastern Europe, they've learned to distrust their government and believe anything that's against their government. And so in some ways, they believe that we're going to be good simply because their government has told them that we're going to be bad.
So what is the answer here? It seems like Ahmadinejad is not going to negotiate. Khamenei is not going to negotiate. Barack Obama famously said in the election that he'd be willing to talk even with Ahmadinejad. Mm-hmm. But now that he's offered the hand and the hand's been slapped, what happens now? President Obama promised Prime Minister Netanyahu that come, what is it, September, October, come the fall, mm-hmm. if we don't get somewhere, he's going to take stronger actions. What can he do?
So one thing at a time. First, there's no necessary relationship between what just happened this election and Khamenei not negotiating. It could very well be that Khamenei, the supreme leader, the one who actually holds the deck of cards in Iran, it could be that he, when he sees Ahmadinejad taking over and the riots in the street, decides to save his own power and begin negotiating. That would be a smart move for him.
We're running out of time, so be very quick in your answer to my second point.
Okay, what can be done in the
right.
in the fall?
Right.
Well, personal sanctions, first of all, can be done. More radio-free sorts of Iran information to get into that country. They don't want a lot coming from America, but they can get more information in.
Much like we did with the time of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. It's always worthwhile to mention that for all the talk about war and a neoconservative look,
how did the Soviet Union fall apart?
Not through force of arms, but through American values and through the people of the Soviet Union rising up against the government. Said that we can help that, I think that's a progressive way to go forward. Rachel Kleinfeld, thank you very much for coming here on the Inside.